interrupting the current neo-Eukaryal, climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 584. Remember, being free is not a spectator sport. We'll get you behind the woodshed. There's a lot of cases coming up. I'm going to talk about a lot of situations explaining exactly what I've been telling you. You have to do it yourself. You have to figure out what's going on. You have to avoid all the pitfalls that are thrown before us, and we still have to make it through. But this place has been usurped, and not too many people noticed. And in the brave new world of the digital realm, the Siberian gulag, as I call it, where they're pushing everybody into it, not many are going to be able to escape, I think. We'll have to see. There's different ways to do avoidances, to try and keep your data yourself, try to keep the surveillance down. I guess this will be a BTW PSA for digital controls that you are better in control of relative to what you do and keeping others from knowing. I don't know anything really about these programs. I've heard of the one. The two of them will looked interesting to me from the standpoint of not phoning home. And I think the other one, Lewis Rossman, supports it, at least Gray J, I believe it is. In fact, the programmer might be working with him completely here. Nevertheless, check them out thoroughly as to their own security as well. Don't take anything blindly. See if they may fit your needs. There may be Fudo's mobile apps, high quality and open source. Cryptogon says, I sometimes used an Android phone and I've started to rely on three apps from Fudo, F-U-T-O. GrayJ, Google's official YouTube app is a disaster. GrayJ fixes YouTube mobile devices. I installed this directly from the APK and not the Play Store in case Google bans it. And that's essentially what I try to look for is I don't go to the Google store and don't look for those programs. And maybe you can track those down. There's quite a few that are available. Check out very carefully what they're doing. Don't just be clicking around. However, get your APK, install it. This one's called Keyboard Beyond Grayjade of Keyboard. Now your keyboard shouldn't connect to the internet. And that's the only thing I look at every time I see people doing and I see this thing. It's monitoring what you're doing. It's sending all this stuff, phoning home, everything you're doing. Just the perfect surveillance device in our hands. The prison right there. We agree to it. Then we pay for it. Interesting. Another one, voice input. Another question here. Situation. This allows you that you do not use, when you use the voice, it doesn't go to Google, and you can use it offline. There's no data stored from it to go do anything. So I thought those were interesting. The things to bring and incorporate. I think one of the best things you can probably do at this point is to de-Google a phone. Find a phone that's de-Googled or get one and do it yourself and start to pair yourself away from all these things. And open source isn't necessarily free from problems or bugs or security. So be careful on that, but they at least allow the community, if you will, the people that can to inspect these things and they will report back usually. Not just here for improving our digital health, but to avoid physical infirmity. Important stories that came down in the health sector here for us, especially with you with little ones. But twins with autism improved dramatically after parents focused on reducing toxic exposure. A new case report details an autism spectrum disorder, ASD, symptoms in twin girls were dramatically improved through personalized lifestyle and environmental modifications. The study documents a parent-led intervention focused on addressing a wide range of modifiable lifestyles and environmental factors and a program of multidisciplinary clinical care and autism coaching. The report, published last week in a peer-reviewed Journal of Personalized Medicine, was led by doctors from the University of Maryland School of Medicine and researchers from the nonprofit Direct Documenting Hope. Both twins were initially diagnosed with level 3 ASD, the most severe type of autism. Between March 2022 and October 2023, their scores on the Autism Treatment Elevation Checklist, ATEC, a tool for measuring changes in ASD severity, dropped from 76 to 32 and from 43 to 4, respectively. Lower scores indicate improvements in symptoms. The girls also showed several other behavioral and social improvements that were maintained for over 6 months at the time the paper was written, with continued improvement noted since the paper was submitted, according to Christopher Adamo, PhD, the lead author. Quote, "The dramatic improvements noted among these girls and in many other cases like theirs demonstrate that much more can be done to improve the symptoms of autism than is often communicated to parents," Adamo told The Defender. Quote, "Our research showed that different genes may be responsible for various detox deficiencies made worse by environmental exposures," he said. "Our kids, all kids, can only handle so many and of a limited amount of environmental toxins." In other words, genes play a role in how well the body can detoxify, but genetics are not the sole or even primary cause. And I'll interject, when you get to link and you read there, the detractors of this, look very carefully, the detractors were people who will or are people that would say that it's only genetics, and they've been advocating that for decades. So look very carefully at this for yourself if you find it interesting. I found it interesting to look into this at least. He goes on to say that's because genes themselves are influenced and modified by environment, according to Beth Lambert, author of A Compromised Generation, The Epidemic of Chronic Illness in American Children, and one of the study authors. Let me interject. Remember, I've talked about epigenetic problem, environmental changes, real time, in our genes, which I hadn't heard of. This is quite a few years ago. So there's a concurrence here with that potential. You literally can be having your genes change. And I'm not talking about your shorts or your pants here. We're also noticing that these messenger RNA treatments can do the same thing, right? And so there's an interesting potential in biology that can allow for these adjustments real time as we go. If we watch the detriment, if it doesn't work out right. There is substantial peer-reviewed evidence showing the modifiable environmental and lifestyle risk factors are linked to autism, including exposure to environmental toxins, poor diet, disruption of the gut microbiota, excessive exposure to non-native electromagnetic fields, industrial chemicals, and accumulation of heavy metals, according to the study. Now, and also we'll get to the point when you get in the read there, but I'm going to leave the rest of it for you to read, find the link, get on the broadcaster, look at Sound Minds and whoever is syndicating with their list of their link-ins. Look and see. They'll talk about when the twins also got vaccines and that they have documented that there was a reaction that didn't happen before. And from there, that's when they jumped in and they started doing some very intensive care. And it did take this clinical observation. It did take a clinical support to identify genetically what they were, and each twin, even though they were twins, was different. So they had, again, the care was specific to each twin. So I'll leave that rest to you. You read it. I've reported in the past on these studies indicating epigenetic changes due to the environmental conditions, at least. So to me, that wasn't foreign. And I think those were all pretty well straightforward before, even though I hadn't known about that direct immediate change. Again, this is predating the mRNA, that you can put a messenger RNA into a cell and it will take it in and it will make a hybrid DNA out of it, and then that goes down line and does other things, which we may or may not know at the moment. So I think it's an important study. If it's applicable to your particular case, I won't read here what the mother and fathers did, again, because it's a case by case, and I don't want to lead that. You can read for that. But your little one, if it's someone you know, it's going to probably very, very specific to them. And very, very interesting. Actually, we would think most things should be. But it's kind of denied in general. So when Harma has no answers here, and you'll hear that in that last story too, you've got to make your own. And certainly be aware and on the lookout for unscrupulous Big Pharma, if we didn't understand that since the great COVID swindle. Merck misled participants in Gardasil HPV vaccine trial. Now, this predates the COVID swindle. the all the rage was going on around this. Well, we see what the Merck did. And listen carefully, is what Pfizer did, but what the Kobe Swindle jab bioweapons did in the, if you remember the studies that we were reading, remember the saline, it was the safest saline solution, and they were having deaths with saline solution. Well, here's the, how they were doing it. In part, it's been exposed again. It's not the first time here either, but it's relevant to what we're saying today. Environmental toxins, medicines that you take, things that no one would understand case-by-case basis. You don't know the predispositions in each one's body. Your genes can change things, be changed by them. A study published in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine has found Merck seriously misled the participants in trial of its human papillomavirus HPV vaccine and compromised their right to informed consent. Aluminum found in adjuvants is a known neurotoxin which is used in vaccines to induce a stronger immune response, but AHS is more potent than traditional aluminum adjuvants, which have been used in vaccines for decades. Merck claims its AAHS formulation is proprietary and to date has refused to provide samples to independent researchers for testing, so the full composition of AAHS remains unknown. The point is they didn't really give the people a fair disclosure, and so they went and went ahead and made the test, and what they used as the placebo was this stuff. They use this material, this proprietary procedure, as a placebo. Not much different than they were claiming that they were doing saline, but we were finding out that it wasn't saline that the COVID swindle jabs were doing. So this is a known practice, just now coming to us. With those of you that are concerned with the HPV, one less, folks. There's one less of you that's healthy, it seems to me, in all this stuff as we move this along. And I'm waiting for the time we stop seeing this type of a fraud on people. If it's really a care industry, then a careless industry and for profit. So apparently the composition's not known of the adjuvant, but also the composition's likely not known about your hospital care. As we hear this story, again, this is just one of the many we heard early on, just coming to confirm us, the guy's a survivor telling their story now. They tried to kill me 3 times, says Dave Dentz. While he was near death and the hospital was trying to get his family to end life support, his family secretly gave him ivermectin. The doctors were baffled by his recovery. But remember, these doctors, you find out, as they say, were sniping for the biggest buck for the bang at warp speed. And I'll let you get the link and watch the video and hear Dave Dentz tell his story surviving the medical industrial complex. It's pretty amazing what we're being exposed to now and what we maybe didn't know or had suspicion, but is sitting there waiting to kill us, all for the profit of fiat also, on top of it all. I can't wrap my mind about any around that, but there we are. You know, I kind of raised up being somebody who kind of care for people. Well, they're caring for themselves, I guess, as far as it goes. But those people that use the black and white here in this great COVID swindle could find it was not preordained, they would be political or medical fodder for profit. We now read, and it's more and more coming, these stories, but this one for particular, Chattanooga. Jury awards $687,240 to the former Blue Cross employee who was fired for refusing COVID vaccine. The Chattanooga jury found that Blue Cross, quote, did not prove by a preponderance of evidence either that it had offered a reasonable accommodation to plaintiff or that it was could not reasonably accommodate the plaintiff's religious beliefs without undue hardship. Tanja Benton was awarded $177,000 of back pay, $10,000 in compensatory damages, and $500,000 in punitive damage. And that $500,000 is to tell the one who made the injury, don't do that in the future. That's supposed to be enough to do that. So we'll hope that that is. And you'll not hear about the communicable disease law, but you did hear about the federal law for what? That's the OSHA accommodation stuff I was reading extensively and actually wrote 2 letters about to help people move them on their way to do that. And I want to remind you, that letter was the letter I suggested was not really the accommodation, the request for accommodation. It was to demand that the employer produce the due process that was declared you to be the principal of contagion. And if they didn't have that, then there's no treatment that they could demand. But neither here nor there, because not very many people pulled that off. But it's there. It's there to do. when the law is there to protect you if we know that ahead of time. Ms. Benton worked at Blue Cross mainly as a statistical research scientist from 2005 through her termination in November of 2021. In her lawsuit, she said that she did not regularly come in contact with people. She said that she worked from home for a year and a half during the pandemic. So those are the accommodations I was explaining before, as I said, in the protections. But after first challenging the employer didn't have any lawful basis in absence of the faithful compliance with that local communicable disease law, I keep mentioning over and over, sits there, black and white, objective basis, which also requires, isn't that, requires that the doctor is the exclusive agent of care for treatment. Now, that's not a license to be king. No, it's what it does is it binds you to that patient, and that patient is actually the ultimate decider. This was supposed to be a list of choices of treatment, not a command. And the local communicable disease law explains that if anybody was to read it. So you'd think that the law created enough presumptive immunity from communicable disease medical tyranny, but apparently not until the Supreme Court says so. And you watch that scant, but here we are this week. The Supreme Court, Trump entitled to at least presumptive immunity from the prosecution for all his official acts. And I'm going to touch these because I'm seeing a lot of people run and scream and yell and pull their hair out about all this stuff. And this is a big deal. I'm not going to diminish this at all. These are big deals. Getting this squared away. All the lack of understanding about this causing so much harm and delays and the wrong ideas, it allows the division that's wanting to be fomented to keep the questions running amongst people themselves. I'm at least in all these cases I'll be coming through here that came up this last week. I'm astonished at how little people understand about the country that they live, the laws of the country they live in, the process and the procedures. And that's telegraphing something. And I've talked about it for years and years, that without this basis, we are easily led, Vince, easily led by the nose and by other people. It looks like they're talking the proper interpretation. Anyway, absolute immunity is in carrying out core constitutional powers and presumptive immunity for all official acts. Quote, Congress may not criminalize the president's conduct in carrying out the responsibilities of the executive branch under the Constitution. Remands to determine whether actions at issue were official or personal in this case. The U.S. Supreme Court just released its opinion on Trump's presidential immunity. We conclude that under our constitutional structure of separated powers, the nature of the presidential power requires that a former president have some immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts during his tenure in office, at least with respect to the president's exercise of his core constitutional powers. Let me just interject here. I'm going to try not to interject. I'll just read through. There's a lot to get through. They're referencing a document. It's called the Constitution. I wish more people would go read it and go read it like what the Supreme Court's going to be talking about. Read it for what it says, not what you think it says. Read it as a strict textual document of some authority, absolute authority, actually. And then we move from there. And if you don't read for that, you're off the point. You're extrajudicial, you're extrajurisdictional, you're extra-constitutional, and all this stuff starts to fall out real quick, and things don't work out well. His core constitutional powers. Go read them. Go find out what they are. This immunity must be absolute. As his remaining official actions, he is also entitled to immunity. At the current stage of proceedings in this case, however, we need not and do not decide whether the immunity must be absolute, and instead whether a presumptive immunity is sufficient. It is these enduring principles that guide our decision in this case. The president enjoys no immunity for his unofficial acts, and not everything the president does is official. The president is not above the law, but Congress may not criminalize the president's conduct in carrying out the responsibilities of the executive branch under the Constitution. And the system of separated powers designed by the framers has always demanded an energetic, independent executive. The president, therefore, may not be prosecuted for exercising his core constitutional powers and is entitled, at a minimum, to a presumptive immunity from prosecution for all his official acts. that immunity applies equally to all occupants of the Oval Office, regardless of politics, policy, or party. One thing of particular note to me, at least, because it highlights the incompetence of the judges and the other Bar Association lackey attorneys we the people suffer by, is this comment here. The concerns we noted at the outset, the expedition of this case, the lack of factual analysis by the lower courts, and the absence of pertinent briefing by the parties thus become more prominent. We accordingly remand to the district court to determine the first instance, with the benefit of briefing we lack, whether Trump's conduct in these areas qualifies as official or unofficial. So this case is about the Missouri censorship case. It seems, as with that Missouri case, which I'm going to get to as well, seems more like a Bar Association, a continuing learning education class in Law 101, and not only any more than that. Listen carefully to what they just said there. They're sending it back to do the basics here. Being a continuing learning education class, it is neither partisan or political. We're not even there yet. So people are politicizing this thing, and the court's coming back and saying, wait, you didn't even do the basic Law 101 stuff here. We want to send that back, and how about you make that record for us? Show us what you have to on the record. My listener should also have heard what should have been ordered in the Missouri case, which is a simple remand, normally back to the circuit court instead of the district court, as stated here. And I found that very interesting. So this is an equity case. They're going to go right back. They're not going to go through the long, drawn-out process to have each court that was involved go back and rethink and rewrite and do whatever. This is going to go right to the beginning. There's not even a record here. This is a really big case this way. They're slapping it down pretty good at this point. That we're going to drop this thing right back in the district court and do your basics. Come back to with something, a record, we can actually chew on a bit here. And so... again, this is just a big deal in my mind about how they did that and to get the proper hearing and judicial determination. This case, as in the Missouri case, essentially is a masterclass admonishment, instruction to the judge and attorneys on the much more proper adjudication of these cases and not a determination of an issue of law, which I think everybody's like lost in. This is just a procedure, due process, failure of due process case here. In other words, we the people are not being served well here. We look down to the beginning of this. They're not served well by that federal district court. The Bar Association judges or the Bar Association attorneys, they'll presenting the cases. That's the Article 3 incompetent territorial district court and judges, the magistrates and senior judges aside. I'm not even getting there yet. That's likely something the Supreme Court may never touch, but we're watching the whole of the bar members failing on us here. And yet I see people getting all partisan and political about it. We're being instructed, the judges here and the attorneys are being instructed to do better in the law, do the due process that was required. So at the link you'll find the court case, a PDF link to that Supreme Court. And understanding this information will give you more power when you read it. I know people don't like doing this, but read it because it gives you more power of discernment and awareness when you're reading this stuff, when you're watching it. It's what I do. You look at the quotes and you start applying what they're doing in the law. It's not that I embrace the Supreme Court so much. It's that, are you qualifying? Are they doing it right too? And this year, these cases seem really clear cut. A few of them. There's a couple that are clear cut too, but in a different way, not the due process side. As you decide to take, responsibility for yourself from the reliance on your coverted captors here that they haven't told you about, when you start to take them behind the woodshed, you have this understanding better than they do. So that's one of the key features I've been trying to tell you that you need to have for you. One last thought on the final, not the final thing to note here. There's lots to look at. It was the Sotomayor dissent in this case. Go down and read that. While I believe, if you're looking at a different case, which I'll just reference but not talk about here, her dissent in reasoning was much more correct in the Grants Pass homeless case, where that case was decided to criminalize homelessness. Yes, criminalizing homelessness. I couldn't even read what I was reading. Gorsuch, in the court, under his weak, hand-wringing irrelevance rationale, if there was any actual rationale existed, allowing the criminalization of homelessness. It's like as if homelessness is like the new black, y'all. And don't underestimate that where this case was in the South Oregon area, where they say it's the climate. That's the motto. Start putting all this together. I just can't understand how it's not, someone's not writing a book or a play. I could not believe that decision one little bit, but Sotomayor, I thought she brought up the good dissent in that case. But back to the dissent here in this case, in her immunity, this immunity case at Sotomayor, not so much. If you go look and see it. But her cautionary caveat is important to read, given the lack of confidence of the law and the lawful procedural acumen of the district court judges, as evidence in this and the Misery court case. They're both about due process failures. Again, Law 101, breach. These judges in the district court are the law. They're supposed to be, when they make a decision, that's it. Now, we do have the review, but my point is that's deemed to be the law. I would have expected a whole lot more, as I continue to tell you about. Be careful when they don't give it to you. They're not going to give it to you, so you better protect it. You protect yourself before you, as you're walking in, to watch that they're not, and start making filings or whatever arguments. And this is not just the courts. This is anybody you're going to talk that comes at some kind of an authoritas. Even though we're not judicial, an administrative hearings officer follows these administrative rules that are really due process oriented, and they will do the same problems as these judges do. It seems like the whole of the Bar Association membership and then its fallout, everyone pretending to be someone like that, just it can't do the basics. So I believe in this case, in the dissent in this case, Sotomayor is incorrect to say there is no presumptive immunity, rather inferring only a general culpability. In fact, her warning to us seems to speak to the contrary of her stance against considering a presumptive immunity. For if you think about what then is left to challenge absolute immunity, if any challenge can exist. And on the other hand, does she intend no immunity at all? The type afforded environmental groups to decimate production, opening the door to all challengers here, and every action, any and every action of the president without some measure of due process protection so as to not unduly encumber the legitimate acts of the president. That's what the Supreme Court's talking here. These core functions are the executive office's executive power. Congress can't challenge that. That's what they're saying. You can't go after them for those core official acts. It is execution of your will, let's say, of the Congress. So presumptive immunity appears to be consistent with the requirement to provide an adequate and sufficient complaint, more likely here, not just any and every complaint as denied in the Misery case, no concrete or particularized actionable link to the officials, as you'll hear there when we get there. And you'll see the consistency between these and what they've done here, the Supreme Court's kind of doing. It has nothing to do with politics. It has nothing to do with party membership, affiliation, none of that. It's strictly due process. And there's reasons why an office official working within the office is to be not harassed by people that essentially maybe philosophically dislike what he's done. See, so when you read this case as well, where it's discussed that Hines is her link, she's linked tenuously here. That admits the fact that, and I hope it's fixed on remand, under the right to amend the complaint to tighten up that part and about going after Facebook. And the government through Facebook and the official government coercion that's been already on the record here in this case, let her tighten that case up. The dissent acknowledges this ability that she did have standing that Barrett says was tenuous. That admits it's there. There's not a standard about that. It's just a matter of did you do it? Even as tenuous, there's now another due process that comes in order to find out if that was adequate. And if not, then you can still get an amendment to your complaint if you know how to, just to know how to ask for it. So presumptive immunity at least allows for rebutting a claim of immunity where the court provides for absolute immunity. So I'm not liking what Sotomayor was saying. She's almost insinuating that there should be no immunity, and that's just, that would be, no, it's never been over, it's never seen that way. All the time the United States has been existent, there's an absolute immunity to the extent of the core functions within the core functions. And those are not to be challenged. And those aren't to suffer even a paper filing. So absolute immunity, though, in and of itself is a problem, granted. But as Roberts explains in the case, and I'm going through this because I want people to kind of get off, understand what's going on so we don't get buried by all these opinions that are coming out. Throw this into understanding due process better for ourselves, and then we don't have to get balled up with people who decide that they know better, and they're not, no one's really looking at the basics and not extending out. When you don't do better, what happens? You start getting cases like this, and delays and all this other stuff, and worse, bad decisions. So they said, Roberts says, we conclude that under our constitutional structure of separation of powers, the nature of the presidential power requires the former president have some immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts during his tenure in office, at least with respect to president's exercise of his core constitutional powers. This immunity must be absolute. On the other hand, look at what immunity generally has done to empower the military police state, to protect the Bar Association, the managing members of this whole thing, the judges in particular, making the Sotomayor's dissent warning relevant in that regard, especially when considering the pretense of national security. In this case, I'm not saying that I agree maybe with her dissent. I'm saying that she's warning that she sees how it can be subverted, and I'm suggesting it's already been subverted, why she can say it. And this is a danger. It doesn't mean that you can overthrow the due process, but it is an exploitation that she's warning could happen. So I think we must heed her dissent, and I think we need to read that and understand it. You're watching. I've talked to it all the time as well. This excuse, this pretense of national security, national defense. We're going to have to get that brought into a point. Whether it goes to the courts is not relevant in one regard. The people have to understand it. We're not going to have an understanding as long as I see the noise out there of everyone thinking they have an opinion different than what basic due process is. We have no basis then at all. So in the case of the absolute immunity where her warning sits, where they start to use pretense of authority and official action, we've heard it already since the 9/11. We've watched a lot of it. The court appears to have created a King Biden or a King Trump. I guess see both sides now arguing there was a King Trump or a King Biden, and they're opposite. No, they're going to put a king into the office of president if there isn't a presumptive ability to attack what is claimed to be an absolute immunity. And these are no different than what I was saying about the great Comey swindle. They're going to take an immunity of the state because there was an emergency. No, they have a due process that they have to follow. It's not different here. Not different at all, actually, as I think about that. So unless, when you're making the complaint, unless you can clear the exceedingly high bar for rebuttal when faced with the national security pretense or the type of incompetent judges evidenced in the cases, this one and the other one I'll talk about, this is a very serious threat. Especially if you don't even know it's there. It's, I mean, you're going to lose anyway on that one. But at least if you have a word in your mouth, you bring it to bear, you bring it up. And again, this is, I'm talking a court here with a judge. This has to, anything that somebody believes they're in a position of authority to say so, they want to come underneath some, usually this police power. This is the threat. Police power for us in the states is the same thing as national security in the federal area. It's like used as a license, rubber stamp of power tyranny to the exclusion of any challenge. So Sotomayor wrote in warning us, looking beyond the fate of the particular prosecution, the long-term consequences of today's decision are stark. The court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president, upsetting the status quo that was existent since the founding. This new official acts immunity now, quote, lies about like a loaded weapon, close quote, for any president that wishes to place his own interests, his own political survival, or his own financial gain above the interests of the nation. And that's from a court case, a statement. That's, again, you see it happen before. Komatsu versus United States, 1944. The president of the United States is the most powerful person in the country, possibly the world. When he uses his official powers in any way under the majority's reasoning, he now will be insulated from criminal prosecution. Orders the SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold onto power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon? Immune. 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 So with the failures evidenced by the judicial branch in mind, Sotomayor describes, or as to the same form evidenced in Operation Hindsight 2020 from 9/11 to the Great COVID Swindle and beyond, what is to stop these forms of court tyranny? As I was looking through this and what she was saying. What I find interesting, isn't it a constitutional core function of the president to promote his party, together with the appointments clause to communicate appropriately with Congress, the Congress having the constitutional power to call up the militia, never officially calling any militia if there was an insurrection, in fact condemning the militia that was present? How would this immunity reflect on Trump's lawful constitutional right to lead his political party? As leaders of the party, to promote the party through various election activities, such as the January 6th convention he had. If you look at what he did, you look at not how the media spun it, but how it actually happened. Why wouldn't that have been, under the appointments clause, quite okay? And taking a step back from Sotomayor's plausible excursion, I'm noticing people blowing this all out of context to condemn Trump for this immunity. The presidential immunity here is a thing as old as the first considerations of it. This is not applied as a license to do wrongs, Sotomayor's warning notwithstanding. These are like new issues that have been brought up. Those are valid. We need to look at them. But over the history of this nation, this is not supposed to have been something that you can sue a president over. This is what the courts use to filter the cases that come before it. One of the reasons is that the executive officer has to be shielded in some way from every complaint that someone might have, as I've said philosophically, or maybe I'm saying this a bit imprecisely, but in this case, the chief executive, the president, nor the taxpayer should be required to be harassed by lawsuits for every decision an executive makes. And if you read the beginning of what they were saying in the case of Roberts' decision, that's what he's essentially touching on. In this case, actually in all cases really, the officer is presumptively immune unless and until the complainant can adequately and sufficiently show the act is not authorized by law. This is nothing more than a standing issue in some part. This is in every case. It's also relative to administrative functions, lawful delegation of authority, which is what removing the recent removal of the Chevron agency deference is about. Look at that. See, all these things are all tied together. It's kind of interesting to me. And they're analyzing the due process as well as what was supposed to happen and what has been happening wrongly that they're trying to correct in this. It's about, you don't constrain authority strictly. It's expressly given. If it's not that, then there's no authority at all exists. And once the complainant clears the hurdle, the case can then go forward against the official. Once he shows it's not official or not within the delegation of authority or not within the power, then the case goes forward. But the court sits there to filter these things. So read this decision carefully so you can better be informed, as everyone puts this confusing, they put their confusing, even confounding spin on things. I'm shaking my head. I read some of these things. How did these people come up with these opinions? They look like they were learned people, like they knew what they were talking about. But now they start talking about this, and I'm actually scared about what's out there. People think that they know what's going on, and I look at this. Really, just about due process. What was supposed to happen just on the paper filing? What were the rights, the relative rights? How do we keep these harassing cases out? Has not been looked at, apparently, until this time. And it's a very high level. But I think if it's official acts, if these are official acts, whatever they were, that he's looking at charges, these are really high crimes or misdemeanors. we're really looking at the proof of lawfare. And a party did it. That's why we've never seen it before, because it wasn't supposed to ever happen. And this is almost an observation of desperation, too. But this is the, if you will, this is the country we're inheriting by allowing it as people, as the people. And an occurring, concurring, but separate opinion, Justice Thomas now goes after another requirement that's been overlooked. And he targets the special counsel, private citizen Jack Smith, by Justice Thomas's opinion, for being unauthorized in law to prosecute the special, that he's writing in the special concurrence, likely, which is written to him and intended for further consideration by the lower court on remand when it goes back. The judge is going to be, the district court judge will be looking at what Thomas said here. Justice Thomas just gifted Judge Cannon a reason to blow up Trump's Mar-a-Lago prosecution, another bad sign for Jack Smith. The Supreme Court of the United States capped off the blockbuster run of opinions by ultimately handing Donald Trump a win in his January 6th prosecution, dragging out proceedings by forcing the Washington, D.C. trial court to analyze which alleged acts in his indictment were official and which were unofficial, only the latter of which would afford him no immunity from prosecution. Still, legal experts believe the ruling all but guarantees that there will be no trial before the 2024 election, throwing a major wrench into the special counsel Jack Smith's case and clouding it with uncertainty. In a concurrence which no other justice joined, Justice Clarence Thomas went a step further by strongly suggesting it is his view that Jack Smith was unlawfully appointed as special counsel. And I've touched that law on a previous broadcast. And I explain the word. You go read it. Again, I go and I read it. I'm not making an opinion somehow. You go read it, and you start qualifying the elements and what's required. That guy didn't look like he was valid to me. Justice Thomas got an opportunity to bring that to the lower court's attention. But, you know, in this case, I think it's proper. Why? Because the lower court judge failed on so many levels here. This is a judge that's supposed to be the determinant of law at that level. And failed the most basic law 101 thing. Trump's defense lawyers, among their numerous, they failed to do it. It's not a question of whether did they kind of cross a line a little bit. No, they just failed to do this stuff. Abjectly failed. The most basic due process requirement. The things we talk about here behind the woodshed all the time to try and make sure if you're going that way, even administratively, they're coming after your property, they're coming after whatever you're doing. And we know it's a limited government. They're not being too limited. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about here, making sure all those things are done and making sure they're done in such a way that they are material errors so that we can get them thrown out if you're going to be there anyway. I'm not saying go down to sue and make up stuff. No, when they come after attack you, you better have that word in your mouth. A lot of it's procedural here. They can't get the procedures down right. It is a limited government. They can't come after you. Trump's defense lawyers, among their numerous motions to dismiss the Espionage Act case, have argued that Smith's appointment to the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland's violated the Constitution because Smith was a private citizen, DOJ alum, at the time of his appointment, not a Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney like Special Counsel David Weiss of Hunter Biden's prosecutions. Let me interject here. In the same words, what I was telling you about the magistrate judges and the senior judges are no longer Senate confirmed and don't have a commission. The senior judge has given it up and the magistrate has never gotten one. It's the same discussion here that these magistrate judges and these senior judges making decisions at the district court, which are also territorial courts, it looks like, and only and solely have no jurisdiction. It's exactly the same thing. And I'm talking about it because I've talked about this stuff, and here we have a Supreme Court case where there's a Supreme Court justice saying, I don't think that was supposed to go that way. And he can't make a decision because he's looking in review. But there's no record, as we were told, so he can't even make a decision. He just says, what he notices should be this. Maybe, why don't you consider that? Without saying, judge, why don't you consider, district court judge, just consider this. This is what it's about. Thomas, who is a justice assigned to field emergency applications from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which includes Cannon's jurisdiction, was definitively removed any doubt about his degree of interest in the question of the constitutionality of Smith's appointment. Really quickly here, understand this is another thing I've had people look at. Do you want to go in through the emergency power of this of one justice and try to convince that justice to present this to the body of the justices? This is another provision right there that he just kind of glances over, that sits there as a potential thought. You have to think about how do you want to, do you want to go through a normal filing in the Supreme Court? Do you want to try and get a judge to present it for you, essentially, as an emergency? And so you got to have a lot of elements, and there's a lot behind this. But there's interesting stuff in this. If you've never heard of it, right here in these stories, is what we don't understand as a population. And we don't even, on minor levels, we don't bring this up when we're working with or having to defend ourselves because of an attack of a local official or anybody, actually. None of this ever kind of comes out of our mind on how we will proceed or that we can at all. Now, for Thomas, the attempted prosecution of Trump for official acts, quote, threatened our constitutional order. But also of concern was the appointment of private citizen Smith to embark on that mission. Quote, if there is no law establishing the office of special counsel occupies, then he cannot proceed with the prosecution. A private citizen cannot criminally prosecute anyone, let alone a former president. Quote, close quote, Thomas wrote on the January 6th case before urging the lower courts to answer whether a non-Senate approved Smith was lawfully appointed at all. This is big stuff, folks. This is a big deal. That's all the kind of stuff I've been talking to you about. Qualify everybody, everything. There has to be a law giving them power. That's why I say we get to the appointment. What about the appropriation? There was no special counsel office. There's no money that they should be paying this guy. It's all waste, fraud, and abuse and theft of the Treasury. This stuff gets big really fast if we could just get a judicial system that didn't drag its feet for 30, 40 years. Thomas said that this is no trifling technicality either. No kidding. See, he agrees. Given the special counsel purports to wield the executive branch's power to prosecute, the consequences are weighty. Our Constitution's separation of powers, including its separation of the powers to create and fill offices, is the absolutely central guarantee of a just government and the liberty that it secures for us all, he concluded. There is no prosecution that can justify imperiling it. And I think it was last week I mentioned, again, the citizens are not free to prosecute. That is to the state and through their bar member. But anyway, the state does the prosecution for crime. So he's talking about the same thing I was. I think it was last week. I can't remember now. Cannon has not yet ruled on Trump's challenge to Jack Smith's authority to prosecute, but it's worth watching how much of Thomas's a concurrence features in the eventual ruling. I will have to say, yes. But see, this is what's supposed to be done. Challenging the authority of someone or the power or the jurisdiction is something that's supposed to happen immediately. And I don't see courts doing that. And the jurisdiction, like subject matter jurisdiction, the jurisdiction that empower a court, those are on the record. And if they don't exist, the court's supposed to keep that door, the federal court keeps that door closed. It's the obligation of the complainant to open that door. So if you don't have the right key, and it's sufficient and adequate, you don't open that door. You're not worthy, if you will, for that. Your case just doesn't match what they can do. So these are guidances for us as well. There's limits to entry, and you have to meet those. You have to jump, you have to scale those thresholds, is what they're actually called. So Justice Sotomayor said generally about killing a political rival, though, we see this thing working out right in real time, is what David Oronovich just posted on ex-Twitter specifically and got thumped by those who don't read the opinion and displaced their own opinion instead of what the justices said but they said in proper context is misinterpreted. The mindlessness here and hypocrisy is amazing to witness when I look at it. I'm shaking my head all the time. That they live among us is quite terrifying, actually. When I'm watching it, this is supposed to be us. The population is supposed to look over and judge maladministration. I don't think we're capable. However, I hold out hope. BBC presenter calls for Trump to be assassinated. Shocking headline. The comment came after Republican presidential frontrunner was granted immunity by a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. BBC presenter David Oronovich has called for the murder, in quotes, murder, of former U.S. President Donald Trump in a post on X Twitter. Yovanovitch later deleted his message following a backlash, claiming it had been satire. Yovanovitch, the voice behind the British state broadcaster's Radio 4 program, The Briefing Room, tweeted on Monday, quote, "If I was Biden, I'd hurry up and have Trump murdered on the basis that he is a threat to America's security," close quote. Now, let me just interject before I move on. Didn't you just hear me say that was what I looked like Sotomayor was telling us that could happen? He just voices that. And people went nuts, apparently, enough to back him off. But if you read his post, that's pretty satirical to those of us that read and think. Read it like an onion, or a Babylonian bee, or a meme, not a Karen. Quote, "If I was Biden, I'd hurry up and have Trump murdered on the basis that he is a threat to America's security." That's cutting satire as well, just right there. The headline, "Immune King Biden considers murdering Trump as an official act." In satire, it represents the dangers in the immunity without clear guardrails. Like you already heard it in the 2010 secret murder memo justifying extrajudicial killing pursuant to a core constitutional function for national security years ago. But again, I've been through these things. As they came up, they were phenomenally important. We reference them again today. He is declared a terrorist by the assessment and extraditionally murdered, is what Yovanovitch is saying. And then we're told after the fact. Doesn't seem outside of what the presidents have already done, despite the hand-wringing commentary to the contrary. I don't think, with the debasement of the law or the pretense of licenses provided by invoking national security, that the judicial system is up to the task to keep the presidential party powermongers within an objective core duty constraint. In particular, with the pretense of national security threat hole the planet can fit through here. This is a monstrous problem. I wrote back in 2018 on Twitter before it went X. What did people think going extrajudicial by executive expedience the 2010 murder memo meant? And don't forget, as the U.S. empire does abroad, it does at home. # shoot first, think later. But what is human rights anyway, really? And here we are. As I've also been pointing out routinely, we all witnessed the lack of constitutional core constraint of law in the great COVID swindle, the tyranny committed, or more particularly for this, by omission of officials and lack of judicial remedy to timely check the death, harm, and societal destruction that an assumed but not presumed immunity to act wrought upon us. And you can witness here again those without critical thought, discernment, or adequate awareness, to name a few, attack, vilify, condemn someone, pointing out an applicable consequence of this. Thought it was kind of funny when I read it. Go ahead and put that into place. Put words to that and see what it sounds like. People were not liking that too much, but that's the truth of it. It's a shame that he felt that he had to pull that back. But take it to the extreme without constraint, as some immediately did. On the one hand, the Post exposes Biden King now, or right now, as this thing went out, and can execute Sotomayor's warning immediately, to the horror of those that support Biden, but don't want to admit he is also known as Genocide or Joe or the Big Guy. And those wise guy underneath foreign agent regime influencers may try to pull something like that off, just like they did with JFK. You'll start seeing how this is applied all the way back. You start running this back. Or on the other hand, that Trump will have the same power after the fact, if elected, if he survives the Banana Republic CIA hit attempt against him. All that non-contextual hand-wringing aside here, at least what we have right now is the black and white interpreted to say a president is immune only as long as he can rebut the rebuttal that his acts aren't official. As we read from the article again, on Monday, the highest court ruled that under our system of separated powers, the president may not be prosecuted for exercising his core constitutional powers and is entitled to at least presumptive immunity from prosecution for his official acts. That clearly was not clear before for those of you whom may be so interested to apply yourselves in some substantive way. It's now stated. The lack of that clarity is what's causing the so-called, I would say it's really confusion and ignorance that's acting out. The claim that this will cause a tsunami of litigation in the case, you'll see that, is not valid. Actually, being that the tsunami will be generated by presidents not acting clearly within the core constitutional fundamentals, the only peaceful remedy against which is to go to court. And so you can't act if he's within a core constitutional power. You can act, go sue him. And if this now clearly opens up what that threshold is, then we're going to see some cases. Otherwise, it's going to be like it's been for the start of this country. And I'm not saying wrapping my arms around this and embracing that there was the perfect thing. I'm not talking about a lot right here. I'm just trying to go through what these cases were doing and how so much noise has been going on and their misdirections and distractions. And we have to have a basic understanding based on what the foundation of how we're going to be responding as we move into this future, because it's going to get a lot more abstract. And we're going to have to be able to root it, put it down on some foundation that's objective, not an opinion, not spouting off, because we want to be a Trump cheerleader or a Biden cheerleader. And the checking and the balancing of the court, that's the core constitutional function of the judiciary. Well, at least the Supreme Court, which arguably is solely established pursuant to Article 3, you know, right? Or as I've said over and over, you referenced, stated in Kansas versus Colorado 1907, disputes between them, the states, and it ends up being the people as well, must be settled either by force or else by appeal to tribunals empowered to determine the right and wrong thereof. Force under our system of government is eliminated. So for all the hand-wringers saying we're going to have a tsunami of court cases, no, we got to go to court. Otherwise, we're back into what? Civil war or worse. And yet, the courts say that they're there. But we also have that problem. I'm not saying this is perfect. I'm just trying to show we don't have to get all bent out of shape about what we're hearing and go political or go party-wise or whatever. Look at the due process failures and watch. That's what they're doing to people. These failures are all the time. These are just the ones that rise to the top. And yet, the courts are promising they're there to stop us from going to force. That's the right to alter and abolish. So we got some perfection steps going on here as well. So what nationals that can develop standing concretely and particularizedly linked is particularizingly a word? I guess it is now, if it wasn't. What particularizingly linked nationals beneficially interested in keeping the republic might consider is looking into the acts or omissions where there is a duty to act, not a mere discretion of a president, and see if an action can be filed to challenge acts not within a core function to stop those acts and declare a culpability. At least bring them to notice by more people if you're going to do that. This is like running for candidacy. Just make an issue. You now have the platform. Make your candidacy just the tool to inform more people of what's on, what's going in, what's going on. Maybe the challenge might be to, say, supply weapons to the land committing war crimes under the pretense of right without actual warrant in law. The lack of reliance on Chevron deference now and strict interpretation of the text of law may help as we see these cases rolling forward. I believe the standard will be applicable to the states, the standard of strict interpretation of the text of an act or omission to act where there is an established duty has now been bolstered, given the evasion to do so by most all governments, operatives, as far as I can tell. So you're still going to have fertile ground to move, but it's now clearly delineated through this case. They're pushing strict interpretation of the strict letters that you see written, and if that doesn't exist, the government authority does not exist. Exactly what I was telling about going after the COVID swindle duties. For each one of you, you could press that. And nothing should happen until that was fulfilled. And if it did happen, you had a remedy called the habeas corpus. Or it could have been injunction. There's a couple of others. I just posted on the habeas because that's the most important, powerful one, the most fundamental, constitutionally recognized one, not a statutory one. So I gave you two links about my my responses back when, relative to that I read, I just quoted you off to. You can see those in the links, or if you've not, maybe you've already seen them on the video. For those of you watching the Sound Minds and all the channels that are subsidiaries to syndicating this. But this week, in the last week, we have really been seeing the long-needed course correction. This case, now coming, that I'll talk about in particular, has been a formidable obstacle to justice, property, and rights. It helped make the administrative deep state that's destroying our lives. I think that's an actual deep state. We kind of want to say, oh, it's the covert CIA. I think the deep state is this active agency administrative one. It starts around the 1940s. 1946 laws, stack them and pack them, and right before that, the Supreme Court in the 30s, Roosevelt's New Deal, and then we got the Green New Deal, same type of thing. Yeah, this has been a long-term violation, making its way and metastasizing as a cancer against lots of rights. And so, this case here, Supreme Court strikes down Chevron, curtailing power of federal agencies. In a major ruling, and I think that's an understatement, the Supreme Court on Friday cut back sharply on the power of federal agencies to interpret the laws that they administer and ruled that the courts should rely on their own interpretation of ambiguous laws. Let me interject right there. I'm going to try not to interject too much again. On the ambiguous law, this problem, 18 or so thousand cases, all these years, 40 years or so, all those were just based on the ambiguous laws. Doesn't it touch the ones that are not ambiguous? Think about what they did with the little bitty anomaly, how they've blown it out of proportion. This decision will likely have far-reaching effects across the country, from environmental regulation to health care costs. By a vote of 6-3, the justices overruled their landmark 1984 decision of Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, doctrine. Under the doctrine, if Congress has not directly addressed the question at the center of the dispute, a court was required to uphold the agency's interpretation of the statute as long as it was reasonable. But in a 35-page ruling by Chief Justice John Roberts, the justices rejected that doctrine, calling it fundamentally misguided. Justice Elena Kagan dissented in an opinion joined by Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Kagan predicted that Friday's ruling, quote, will cause a massive shock to the legal system. They only listen about their system. They're not worried about justice here or what it's done. But Chevron defense, Roberts explained in his opinion for the court in Friday, is inconsistent with the Administrative Procedures Act, the federal law that sets out the procedures that federal agencies must follow, as well as instructions for courts to review actions by those agencies. The APA, Roberts noted, directs courts to, quote, decide legal questions by applying their own judgment, and therefore, quote, makes clear that the agency's interpretation of statutes, like agency interpretation of the Constitution, are not entitled to deference. Upon the APA, Roberts wrote, concluded, it thus remains the responsibility of the court to decide whether the law means what the agency said. Roberts rejected any suggestion that the agencies rather than the courts are better suited to determine ambiguities in the law, but what that might mean, even when those ambiguities involve technical or scientific questions that fall within an agency's area of expertise. Roberts emphasized, quote, Congress expects courts to handle technical statutory questions, and the courts also have the benefit of briefing by the parties and friends of the court. Stare decisis, the principle that courts should generally adhere to their past cases, does not provide a reason to uphold Chevron doctrine, Roberts continued. Roberts characterized the doctrine as unworkable, one of the criteria for overruling prior precedent because it is so difficult to determine whether a statute is indeed ambiguous. Justice Clarence Thomas penned a brief concurring opinion in which he emphasizes that Chevron doctrine was inconsistent not only with the Administrative Procedures Act, but also with the Constitution's division of power among three branches of government. The Chevron doctrine, he argued, requires the judges to give up their constitutional power to exercise their independent judgment, and it allows the executive branch to, quote, exercise powers not given to it. But listen here to this caveat. Justice Neil Gorsuch filed a longer 33-page concurring opinion. Quote, all today's decision means is that going forward, federal courts will do exactly as the Congress has since 2016, exactly as it did before the 1980s. Listen to the timing here. Listen to what I talk about. Listen to how the overthrow starts to happen and when. And exactly, as he writes, exactly as it has done since the founding, resolve cases and controversies without any systemic bias in the government's favor. In the government's favor? Doesn't sound like an unbiased judiciary to me. But when you understand this, and let's say regarding land disposal, when it is evident, if not readily acknowledged by these Bar Association members, that it is the obligation and trust duty to protect land disposal in favor of the government shifts to its burden to protect its disposal, and the court ought to be duty bound to find in your favor of the government and into that the obligation to protect these because of the denunciation of Chevron has this impositional effect as well. It really can shift this burden if you know that it sits there. In any of dealing with an agency, it will still be imperative to evidence the privity of the property or disposal thereof, the lack of jurisdiction then, or authority over the property over which the trust obligation of government to protect its disposal is prevailing against the agency. It still requires you do that. It's inequity, so you got to bring your title. I've always said this, so this is all confirming. Again, these decisions, I haven't seen anything but confirming what I've said, and they will now open up quite a bit for those that understand a bit of this and come to the place where they need to use it. I'm not going to say it's a road paved to gold now, or your problems aren't over. What I'm saying is that there's not going to be this government bias, and more and worse, it's a special interest bias that's working within that system that's given the kingship, if you will, inside the administrative agency. So this works very similarly, as I've explained prior. A judge does not have jurisdiction to alter anything about the land patent, only having enough jurisdiction to protect the property evidenced by that ultimate evidence of disposal of the land patent. While on the other hand, an administrative hearings officer or a proceedings has no power within its delegation of authority, different term here, to interfere with the land disposal of government. As I've explained before, the judge can't reach down and touch the patent, and the hearings officer can't reach up high enough to get it. And so those things are set forever. That's why there says forever on them. But that's how I rationalize how this works. I was able to look at it. It's way back in 2010 or before we started even doing our lawsuit. But for instance, here, the delegated authority of an administrative agency officer to determine those rights does not extend to alter any rights evidenced in the land. If you look at a definition for a hearings officer, he's to determine rights. The land patent already does that. There's no place for him as a hearing officer. But being that those rights are already determined by Congress and evidenced ultimately in that land patent. In a way, I get kind of excited a bit. Here's, again, this base law coming, the foundation that we were given, the uniqueness of this country, where I can't find it in lots of other places. I certainly found it right here. And this case is talking right to that, if you look, peer through it. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 584. For people who may have lost a case decided by Chevron precedent and want to challenge, take note here, qualifying your case to exceed this limitation that Roberts writes, because they're not going to really let lots of challenges of prior decisions, but listen to what he says. It's a little guidance. Roberts indicated the court's decision on Friday would not require earlier cases that relied on Chevron to be overturned, not require that they be overturned. Mere reliance on Chevron cannot constitute a special justification for overruling a decision upholding agency action, because to say a precedent relied on Chevron is, at best, just an argument that the precedent was wrongly decided, which is not enough standing along to override the rule in the case. So you bring more. you make sure you have, go find out what that special justification needs to be, meet that. But then these cases can go back and be they won't be re-adjudicated. I don't think they'll be calling them that, but you'll be able to challenge them, challenge those decisions based on this. And so this is a big deal. I'm talking really to property owners and stuff like that, like the EPA ruined their lives. Really go look. I'm not saying every case can be done, but I don't know that. I haven't looked. I don't know them. But you need to look back on these things, all these agency decisions. They are all problems I talked to you about, like the miners and the plan of operation. Wrong. You go read the text. It totally doesn't matter. The miner isn't even involved. And this is the whole point about government. The government is limited to itself. Its rules are really attached to itself and its property. I hope you heard that. Your citizens of the United States are the government's property. There's a rule about that, too. Anyway, going on here, that there is also the potential in other cases here. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on Monday on when the set statute of limitations to challenge agency actions begin to run. The federal court has argued in that case, Corner Post versus Federal Reserve, that if the challenger prevails, it would open the door for a wide range of belated challenges to agency regulation. Go find that out. The rule has been, that I understand, the time doesn't start tolling until you get word that you had a problem. And then your time tolls. And so this is going to be that case. So don't think it doesn't pertain to you. This case may be used as your public notice that you should have gone and checked to whether or not your case is subject to a review. Again, then meet the other standard. So what are we to expect? We can read. Roman Martinez, who argued on the case in behalf of one of the fishing companies, applauded the decision. Quote, by ending Chevron deference, he said in a statement, quote, the court has taken a major step to preserve the separation of powers and shut down unlawful agency overreach. Going forward, judges will be charged with interpreting the law faithfully, impartially, and independently without deference to the government. This is a win for individual liberty in the Constitution. The comment against that is that this is going to make chaos in the whole system. Judges will be making decisions, and I have to agree. But the way it's kind of judges we're seeing, maybe that's going to happen. But bring your case, bring your title, bring your law. Don't let them get away with it. It's going to be better than, because that can be challenged if it's wrong, but it'd be better than having the court, the government, the special interests behind the scenes, having their environmental way with you, having their special interest way with you. Looked at like they are a god. That stops. Anyway, don't laugh at how this might work. There it is to insist anyway on this. Don't dismiss what's going on here. I know we don't seem to get reflection of it, but these are the things that have been hurting us all this time as well. And now we have another tool in our tool bag here. But remember, if an agency without jurisdiction or authority attempts any action when it lawfully has no power, you can go straight to the court. You don't have to go exhaust. There's no administrative exhaustion here, as I've told you over and over again. This is speaking to that, too. There's a trespasser against you. You don't wait around. You don't argue with the trespasser. And so your administrative remedies don't exist because they're not supposed to attack you. You go right to the judicial ones. And you go after you protect your property and appurtenant rights. Remember, appurtenant rights. That's what Wayne Hage didn't understand. I never heard the term come out of his mouth. And the court was explaining that to him. Fascinating what people don't know about their property. And he's on the forefront of fighting for property rights. But one final note here in the article, just reading from it. Friday's ruling came in one of these cases during the 2023-2024 term to curtail the power of federal agency, a conservative effort sometimes dubbed the war on the administrative state. In October, the court heard arguments and challenge to the constitutionality of the mechanism used to fund the Consumer Watchdog Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Last month, the court upheld the CFPB's funding by a 7-2 vote, and on Thursday, the justices pared back the power of the Securities and Exchange Commission and other administrative agencies, holding that the SEC cannot continue using in-house proceedings to impose fines in security fraud cases. These are big decisions here. Paring back the administrative state, the functioning deep state, destroying people's lives, property, and enterprise is what I'm reading. I've wasted a lot of my recent life addressing and defeating the effects of lawless administrative excesses. But this insidious Chevron decision has caused, I mean, in the process of everything. Some of the time, the law wasn't ambiguous. More than the agency or a special interest group, whether or not sleeping in bed together, misframed the situation, making the law sound ambiguous. They created the ambiguity so they could do this deference. And the real heinous part is the courts would go with that to invoke in their invocation of Chevron. So far, the biggest whiners about the change here seem to be the special interest or environmental groups, because they could exploit Chevron to push their destructive agendas. I was dealing with it firsthand, and I wonder how much benefits this RFK Jr.'s destructive waterkeepers and other special interest groups got from Chevron as they attacked production and private property, or as they exploited the indigenous population, advancing the corrupt environmentalist agenda, such as the Sustainable Development to Destroy America. Robert Kennedy Jr., after keeping the waterkeepers groups that he helped work globally now, were instrumentally creating the destructive stalking horse on this. If you remember back to the South Dakota pipeline, I lost a lot of friends and got a lot of flack on that point, trying to point out these problems. That using the indigenous, women, children, and the indigenous, what they use as stalking horses to get an agenda through. And they don't care about women and children and the indigenous. But that pipeline fiasco, remember the girl nearly losing her arm over it? Yeah. These special interests don't care about you. Almost lost her arm. I'm sure she felt that she needed to do that. But they were getting authority that was false to prop up people. And that caused them to not look at the fundamentals. As I was explaining them, trying to get people to not get in trouble, get themselves hurt, really. Don't put themselves in jeopardy. It doesn't mean you don't maybe have an argument, but don't do that. You know, lots of good, hardworking people working here in America, their lives and their finances wasted in fights with the agency allies. Nuts. I remember that isn't just the federal look at what the same special interest infected state agencies are doing as well. For example, with the farmers of the water now. This is all coming, infesting these agencies with these special interests. Then have deference. The states followed that deference, and you see what's going on. And yet you go look at the black and white, what it actually says, they don't have any power at all. Why I say go find your savings clauses? That's black and white. That's the objective basis. Find the laws that exist that they refer to but won't tell you about, because in those laws are your protections as well. But not such a bad decision. Anyway, it's jabbed on that, I don't think. Supreme Court just made it harder for federal agencies to regulate a sweeping ruling. Another story. I want to go through some of these different angles on what they're talking about. A momentous decision that will affect vast swaths of American life. I guess I'm going to interject. That's a big deal. Vast swaths of American life. How bad this was. How many people were hurt and harmed and no way to get back. The United States Supreme Court on Friday undid decades of regulatory law, making it more difficult for federal agencies to issue rules and regulations that carry out broad mandates enacted by Congress. Case Western Law Professor Jonathan Adler generally agreed with the Friday's ruling, though he had added that it may make it harder for the executive branch to react to major crises like the COVID pandemic or sudden disasters in the financial world. These decisions will make it more difficult for future administrations to change policy without going to Congress, he said. But that was the limited form of government. It was supposed to be difficult for the government to affect your life. Maybe that was a good idea that that they use this deference in order to impose the Kobe swindle on us. Maybe it's a good thing it gets destroyed now. Another area affected. The Supreme Court dealt a huge blow to our ability to fight climate change. By overruling the Chevron doctrine that required courts to defer to federal agencies when it came to implementing broadly written laws, the Supreme Court will make it much more difficult for the federal government to regulate pollution, including, but by no means limited to greenhouse gas emissions, among many other things related to health, labor, consumer welfare, taxation, and on. So this statement is one who has benefited from the usurpation of the constitutional establishment. It was what our Jefferson Mining District lawsuit was essentially about, that the both political parties, their members, the state officials, the Bar Association and its members defaulted on. We sued them on this ability they have to destroy us. If you want to read a lot of the ways that violated peace, such as relying on the science and experts, etc., to use in aid of that unassailing deference, read this article as to what they have relied on. This guy is talking about everything they use that's now not available to them. Or at least its narrative is promoted for a couple of generations, 40 years worth now, used here to the hearings as mind, you know, your mind is being programmed by this stuff. As we watched in the takedown of America, and we were oblivious to it. This is a neat article about them whining about all this taken away from them. Everything that they used to exploit us. But not much of his complaint here is valid, but it sounds plausible. It worked to make kings and queens of the administrative division deep state. Those same people that will cry incorrectly about Trump having the same power. Think about this other dynamic. What the court curtailed is eliminating agency deference is the sustainable change agent Stackham and Packham special interest influence in agencies and hearings through so-called experts, the science, and other authorita to cover the usurpers and their usurpation. This Loper decision eliminating agency deference moves these important matters to the courts where property will have better protection. Getting rid of agency deference is better, but not enough, because being the judges have learned to be advocates from the bench, all of which come through the inescapable indoctrination of the Bar Association. So we need to take this relief from tyranny one step at a time, but better than none at all, I'm thinking, with these little adjustments, these course corrections. A decision right after the Loper decision eliminating agency deference came up. But we see the effect. It's right there in what the judge used. Judge overturns Biden's LNG export pause. Remember, sustainable development, climate change, carbon. That's what this we're talking about here. And the agency, the EPA, the pillar of sustainable development, the environmental pillar supporting the global ESGs is what is being addressed when we start looking at this through this other agency, the DOE. DOE's decision went against the language, here we go, textual, strict interpretation, against the language of the Natural Gas Act that was subverting, quote, Congress's determination that LNG exports are presumptively in the public interest. And I'm going to suggest to you, I've told this to you before, all raw materials are in the public interest. That's why when you interfere with them, it's called sabotage. It's a war thing. And we're always in a war. But that's the law. I've talked about all this. But anyway, moving to this here. So there you go. I mean, no deference and strict express interpretation of law is what this judge came back with. It was like within a day after that decision. I have a link to the Loper decision kicking all the agency's kingdom's deference to the curb. And we see in this report here, Judge James Kane of the United States District Court for Western District of Louisiana said in an order late Monday, the DOE's export pause should be stayed in its entirety, effective immediately. There's your jurisdiction, your equity jurisprudence. The ruling came in response to a lawsuit filed by the coalition of 16 Republican-led states, which claimed the administration had overstepped its authority when it launched the freeze. According to Kane, the Natural Gas Act instructs DOE to ensure, quote, expeditious completion of reviewing export applications. He acknowledged the DOE has previously used studies to update how it makes public interest determinations, but, quote, the decision to wholesale halt the process approving applications for non-FTA countries is a complete reversal of how the DOE processed those applications in the past, close quote. Western Virginia Republican Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, however, lauded the court's decision late Monday. West Virginia was one of the 16 states backing the lawsuit. Quote, this is a big win for the country's energy industry and millions of jobs and supports against the attacks from the Biden administration to further its radical climate change agenda at the expense of our economy, he said in a statement shortly after the decision. quote, the administration's energy department has no such authority to justify this ban. Authority on matters like this lies with Congress and Congress only, he added. The ruling requires the Department of Energy to restart the process of considering gas export applications. So, for me, looking at this in minerals, through Jefferson Mining District, this is all we've ever been saying. There's a law, it means something, the administration, the executive, through the agencies, can only promulgate rules to implement that. They can't invent stuff. And this is pretty straightforward. They got quotes here. This is not ambiguous. This is the other side of that. This is not ambiguous. They're making ambiguity, as I said before, out of something that they had no power to do. The agency is just to execute upon Congress's will. That is the core function. Anything outside that is overreach. And so it's pretty, this is really simple stuff in a way. How they get there is long-winded. So I got the case here, like I said. Read this stuff through, get familiar. Anybody with property, anybody that has to deal with an agency, code enforcement, start understanding what's coming on, what the Supreme Court's been doing now in this course correction. It's major. This is major stuff. How it works out, I'm not quite sure. And it all depends on how we, the people, start implementing this course correction to more direct law. We get to get right to the law, not filtered through special interest agency. Stack them and pack them, stuff them full, like you know, stuffing the court they did back in the New Deal issue around 37 or so, which kind of starts this whole devolution as well. In another use case relating to curtailing lawless energy, lawless authority here also. Again, curbing regulatory agencies. Supreme Court rejects the SEC's tribunals. We heard this mentioned in the other case. This is really a large issue. Because, the miners are up against the IBLA, and that's an in-house hearing system. And they are treating what we're doing as not private property inside that agency system. Because that's only the agency can look at. They're the ones that determine the rights. But when your rights are determined by law, they then commit the takings, and they don't recognize it. So this is a big deal, this SEC thing. And you've heard what they've been doing generally. They're a weapon of politics. No. Common in executive agencies, such tribunals hear enforcement actions without juries. The court's conservative supermajority said violated the Constitution. The Supreme Court on Thursday rejected one of the primary ways the Security and Exchange Commission enforces the rules against securities fraud, likely also making it harder for other regulatory agencies to bring enforcement actions. The SEC, like other regulators, sometimes enforces its regulations and imposes penalties using the in-house tribunals without juries rather than federal courts. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., writing for a six-justice conservative majority, said that the practice violated the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial. And what's very interesting to me is Jefferson Mining District would put these sorts of conditions in the public record in court cases and get ignored. So this is kind of a big deal going on here for me with our experience in the last, from my experience, my research, my writings, my authorship, our court cases. And we've argued these because the law says so. We're just doing straight up here. It says this. Why don't we just do this? No, they got to make up all kinds of stuff. The Secretary of Interior is your administrative hearings agent. You heard other agencies might be involved. This IBLA is not lawful. It's right in the law. It's not lawful for what we do. Yet they run it. They'll take you. I've had two decisions come against me. And inside, if you look at the footnotes, they tell you that they lied. In a way, they tell you that it's not applicable if you know what you're really looking. But they still make the precedent for themselves to give them more power. So, in particular, where it decides to take our property, the privately disposed mining property, from some administrative rule and ignores all the challenges, that's taking a property. That's like taking a fine. That's taking a. You got supposed to do takings issues for that. But they were able to do it because of deference. One of the things was deference. Deference to their record. Their record was fraud. We'd challenge all of it, but it would go down in the administrative side, would just destroy that. And the courts wouldn't look at it. The courts were using deference to see how this works. And so mineral interfering with the mineral production for not filing a plan of operations, they would take your claim or give the agency's power, another agency power, when the, it says in the law, I read the definition, that the plan of operations for a minor applies to the federal agency that's making the plan on utilizing the appropriated money for a major federal project, which the court have brought down to any time the money gets used, the agencies have to write a plan of operations for that money, the use of that money, the use of the land. The minor doesn't. Nothing in the law says the minor would. And they would come and take our property over this. So we weren't wrong on these court, on these cases, but we never had a judiciary that was actually following the law. And that's why most people don't deal with it. Part of me is just more like, let's keep pressing, you know, just keep exposing. Maybe, well, I expected more people to be interested in it, but I guess not. I don't know why. But here it all. Here, all these cases are coming to really show what we've been doing. Were we 100% right? I can't say that, but we were right enough. About the water definition for the waters of the United States. We were definitely right on that one. Agency deference. And it was failure. It failed the law, left and right. So, I mean, this is a big deal. This is a massive trust breach that was going on that I'm not sure people can actually fathom. I've been studying this thing for a couple decades now, and I can barely wrap my mind around the problem that appeared normal. I mean, I can just identify it, but really, how they got it there, how encompassing, how comprehensive it was, mind-boggling. I mean, that's why I focus on stuff, because you can't just sit back and try to understand this thing. It's too big. We are in an abjectly corrupt system. That's all I can say. A lot of people shrug their shoulders and give up on that right there. These cases this last couple of weeks are leaning really hard on the rudder for a long-needed course correction of the ship of state. And likely the hand-wringing are from the special interest enemies whining that their ammunition to kill you has been taken away from them. As I can see that, as my experience was watching this. These recent Supreme Court cases are very important to understand, I think. A lot of people won't, and I'm disappointed to know that, but prove me wrong. Prove I'm wrong. Get interested in some of these things. They're actually concise lessons in what we should have never not known. Not just to know the general course being corrected largely in your favor, but that how misinterpreted, that these are already being used to guide off-point, unsupportable, divisive narratives to us right now. That you don't want to waste your time on those people, even if they sound intelligent, they sound like they're your party cheerleader, their party group, you're all rah-rah, Trump. No, we're looking through all that. You don't give anybody credit because they say think like you, because they're actually not. Especially if you're looking like I do through this stuff and see different. You just see different. You don't want to waste your time on all these things when the more direct answer is well more informative and usable to you. You got to filter through this if you don't know it either. And that's another waste of time. So I want to touch on the misery censorship through government coercion case. This case is being sensationalized by everyone. That might seem to hazard a guess of opinion, as with the headline from a website I had thought was relatively neutral in its reporting. Justices side with Biden over government's influence on social media content moderation. It says justices side with Biden to influence social media. But let us look at the text of the article, then eventually the case opinion, to see what it actually said. By this, again, we should be able to understand the nuts and bolts a bit better. What we're told by people and where to place the blame, or more importantly, where not to place the reliance when it's us, our property rights, etc., on the line, and how to proceed more adeptly is our interest here. Again, this stuff is noticed to us. So how is it working? What are people doing? Watch the response to it. Qualify it all. Put everybody in their place, if you will. It's not a judgment in that regard. It's discerning. Discernment, and you don't get lost in being lost. The justices ruled on Murphy versus Misery. The Supreme Court on Wednesday threw out a lawsuit seeking to limit the government's ability to communicate with social media companies about their content moderation policies, By a vote of 6-3, the court ruled that the plaintiffs did not have a legal right known as standing to bring their lawsuit. We're talking due process right here, folks. This is basic stuff. Writing for the majority, Justice Amy Coney Barrett cited the lack of any concrete link between the restrictions that the plaintiffs complained of and the conduct of the government officials, and in any event, she concluded, a court order blocking the communication between government officials and social media companies likely would not have any effect on decision-making by those platforms, which can continue to enforce their policies. Follow these players and their relationship very carefully, and you'll see how the mistakes, well, they shouldn't have been made, but they were made. Again, the Bar Association members pushing this. They're the ones running this front. So the opening paragraph doesn't jive, if you listen to that, with the sensationalized headline, which people seem to grab and run with in these times of the 6-15 seconds of fame knowledge base that we're now seemingly working on. Not having standing, the parties did not have any right to sue. If the parties had no right to sue, how is it that the Supreme Court is siding with Biden? Granted, standing can be a sleazy way for the court to evade taking a case, but or to cover, you know, for its approval. But if that be the potential, then what's required is that we need to look deeper into the opinion and see if the holding is reasonably supported, and then what was done about it to qualify these things for ourselves. In reading the deeper in this thing, you get to a bit, it gets more interesting actually, telegraphing again that at least one complainant may have standing, but the judges and attorneys didn't cover Law 101 Basics yet again on this. Look at all the delay going on with all these professionals. Remember now, the doors of the federal court are closed until an adequate and sufficient complaint is filed, allowing you to open the door, crossing that threshold, they say, those burdens, to enter that court. In this regard, I suggest a Law 101 failure of the lower court judges and the attorneys is not the Supreme Court siding with Biden to coerce social media into censorship. I'm not saying I like what I see, but that's not our problem at the end of this, what they're saying in the Supreme Court, but what the failures were at the beginning. The dissent also indicates it is interested, the justices, in having a go at this case if and when it's proper before it. And this is all orderly stuff, all due process. Everything's got to have its order, and it's the way this thing works. Justice Samuel Alito dissented in an opinion joined by Justice Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, suggesting that the case could be one of the most important free speech cases to reach the Supreme Court in years. Alito would have ruled both that the plaintiffs have standing to bring their lawsuit and that the White House coerced Facebook into censoring at least one plaintiff's speech. Well, there it is, at least one, not all plaintiffs. And this is an interesting thing in the divide in this case, which also offers some other opportunities, I suspect. So this is a big message being telegraphed to get this one right, or we will, the Supreme Court to the lower court. In dissent, Alito contended that the most important role of freedom of speech is protection of the speech that is essential to democratic self-government and speech that advances humanity's store of knowledge, thought, and expression. The speech at the center of this case, Alito insisted, falls squarely within those categories. He conceded that a fair portion of the social media users had to say about COVID-19 and the pandemic was of little lasting value, but he maintained that we know now the valuable speech, which he wrote in a footnote, includes information about the origins of the COVID-19 virus, was also suppressed. In Alito's view, Hines, one of the plaintiffs here, therefore, has shown the kind of past and threatened future injuries attributed to the government officials that should allow her lawsuit to go forward and permit the justices to address the First Amendment question at the center of the case. Quote, the court, however, shirks that duty and thus permits the successful campaign of coercion in this case to stand on an attractive model for future officials who want to control what people say, hear, and think. If this is a standing, the court shirks its duty. If there is no standing, as this court is now encumbered, the court is put on notice not to shirk its duty, the lower court, going forward, as are the attorneys on notice. Again, Law 101 being broken here, didn't even get followed. To return here to my opening contention, though, about the sensationalization, misrepresentation people are attributing to this case, we, or the attorneys and judges, can learn better the fundamentals on this, and maybe we would have cases that go through better. This is a fascinating case, what went on. This is interesting what happened. And I think they might have been disappointed on this, not that that even came up. There should have merely been a question relative to this, at least to one participant. So we'll get to these procedural infirmities, like from this next site I found, sporting another sensational presentation, the website of which I had thought and felt in the past did a decent job reporting on these cases, but which in this case also sensationalizes the failure that the author of that website attributes to the Supreme Court in this case. And despite quotes included in the article from Barrett's opinion that, taken true, shows that to the contrary of this author's assertion, grabbing its headline, his own take on the matter, and he quotes from the opinion, to establish standing, the plaintiffs must demonstrate a substantial risk that in the near future, they will suffer an injury that is traceable to the government defendant and redressable by the injunction they seek. Because no plaintiff has carried that burden, none has standing to seek a preliminary injunction, wrote Justice Barrett. The plaintiffs treat the defendants as a monolith, claiming broadly that the government continues to communicate with the platforms and content moderation issues, continued Justice Barrett. But we must confirm that each government defendant continues to engage in the challenge conduct, which is coercion and significant encouragement, not mere communication. The plaintiffs, without any concrete link between their injuries and the defendant's conduct, ask us to conduct a review of the years-long communications between dozens of officials, federal officials, across different agencies with different social media platforms about different topics. This court's standing doctrine prevents us from exercising such general legal oversight of the other branches of government. And what's the title of this article? U.S. Supreme Court says it's okay for a federal government to outsource online censorship to big tech, curtailing free speech of all Americans. Is not what I just read from the opinion. And so I'm disappointed, but this is what we find. We go to places that we think are good interpreting this and that, and they're not. This is all, seemingly everyone's going to do their agenda. I'm interested that people understand the nuts and bolts of the basics and how they're going to protect themselves when an official comes after them. It's not going to be gotten by reading these headlines and watching somebody put together their opinion that clearly is not correlated in the opinions themselves. So I have this opinion, and we'll read what it actually says in the opening pretty clearly. It brings better clarity than constrained by the headline-grabbing author attempting to prove his opinion there. You read that. Held. And this is the old important part right here. Held. What is the holding? Neither the individual nor the state plaintiffs have established Article III standing to seek an injunction against any defendant. How is that siding with Biden when the plaintiffs didn't bring their case? I'm not saying they didn't and they can't. It sounds like one of them did, and that's the big deal right there. I'm saying, on the overview of this case, with the record that was before the court, nobody looks like they had standing. The Fifth Circuit also erred by treating the defendants, plaintiffs, and platforms, remember the pieces there, listen to what's going on, as each as an unified whole, because, quote, standing is not dispensed with in gross, plaintiffs must demonstrate standing to each claim by they press against each defendant and for each form of relief they seek. This requires a threshold showing that a particular defendant pressured a particular platform to censor a particular topic before the platform suppressed a particular plaintiff's speech on that topic. You hear the instruction set going, continuing learning education to the attorneys who failed to do this? There's your form right there of what you how you have to bring your complaint. Complicating the plaintiff's effort to demonstrate each platform acted due to government coercion rather than its own judgment is the fact that the platforms began to suppress plaintiffs' COVID-19 content before the defendants' challenged communication started. The plaintiffs failed, by and large, to link their past social media restrictions and the defendants' communications with the plaintiffs. The state plaintiffs, Louisiana and Missouri, refer only to action taken by Facebook against the Louisiana state representative's post about children and the COVID-19 vaccine, but they never say that Facebook took action against the official's post. A critical fact in establishing a causal link. I'm reading right from the opinion, not someone's opinion. This is what the court said. This is what the opinion was written at. I would just take this right up front. This seems pretty clear to me. Given this is the record, we're watching. They're explaining the failure right there. That was the attorney. That was an attorney general, or two. Nor have the three plaintiff doctors established a likelihood that their past restrictions are traceable to either the White House officials or the CDC. They highlight restrictions imposed by Twitter and LinkedIn, but point only to Facebook communications with White House officials. Plaintiff Jim Hoff, who runs a news website, experienced election-related restrictions on various platforms. He points to the FBI's role in the platform's adoption of hacked material policies and claims that Twitter restricted his content pursuant to those policies. Yet Holt's declaration reveals that Twitter took action according to its own rules, posting private, intimate media without consent. Hoff does not provide evidence that his past injuries are likely traceable to the FBI or the CISA. Plaintiff Jill Hines, a healthcare activist, faced COVID-19-related restrictions on Facebook. Though she makes the best showing of all the plaintiffs, most of the lines she draws are tenuous. As my interpretation is, and through that other dissent, tenuous should be good enough to go to the meet the threshold and go into the other procedure. Let me just leave that here. This justice thinks it's tenuous. Other justices saw the same thing. That doesn't mean the case is over in my mind because they have the right to amend. But let me keep reading. From the opinion now, not someone's opinion, just generally in the public. Plus, Facebook started targeting her content before almost all of the communications with the White House and the CDC, thus weakening the inference that her subsequent restrictions are likely traceable to government-coerced enforcement of Facebook policies. Even assuming Hines can eke out a showing of traceability, the past is relevant only insofar as it predicts the future. Number three, right from the beginning of this, the holding, the description of the explanation. To obtain forward-looking relief, the plaintiffs must establish a substantial risk of future injury that is traceable to the government defendants and likely to be redressed by an injunction against them. The plaintiffs who have not pointed to any past restrictions likely traceable to the government defendants, i.e., everyone other than Hines, are ill-suited to the task of establishing their standing to seek forward-looking relief. But even Hines, with her superior showing on past harm, has not shown enough to demonstrate likely future harm at the hands of these defendants. On this record, and I repeat that, on this record, from which they determined jurisdiction, on this record, it appears that the frequent intense communications that took place in 2021 between the government defendants and the platforms had considerably subsided by 2022 when Hines filed the suit. Thus, it is no more than conjecture to assume that Hines will be subject to governmental-induced content moderation, as the case that they cite there. But the plaintiffs have redressability problems. The plaintiffs have redressability problems. Without evidence of continued pressure from the defendants, the platforms remain free to enforce or not to enforce their policies, even those tainted by initial government coercion. D. States do not have third-party standing as parens patriae to bring an action against the federal government on behalf of their citizens who have faced social media restrictions. Again, understand the parties, understand the three, these third-party nature of this, what they did, how the attorneys set it up, how they really shot themselves in the foot in a way, not connecting anything. So it's important to read the opinion and understand why that is about this third party standing and the states didn't have standing. Because it confirms other failures Barrett cites, bringing this more to the proper call, not a sleazy evasion, which we've also seen, which the other author actually points to. That's what his concern is. That's what this might be. But this, like, double proves a point that she was writing about. Essentially, links in the chain of the evidence to the perpetrators are missing in this case. The court concludes the holding. We therefore reverse the judgment to the Fifth Circuit and remand the case for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered. So rather than siding with Biden, there was no evidence of direct harm caused by the defendant as claimed by most, if not all, of the plaintiffs there for the court to hear and determine the case originally. So where were these attorneys here in all this, in particular these state attorney generals? Well, how'd they fail to meet Law 101? And I think they need to resign. They did this basic stuff wrong. They're wasting the time and they're defrauding the state treasury and their office and all the private attorneys, their clients, the same way. It's really ridiculous what I look at some of this. Supreme Court has the answer to this? The system isn't set up that we solve this as we go through the court and have it done right? And not that my opinion means much more than maybe a consideration for anybody that might consider this part, if that much, I'm hopeful. The case is ultimately remanded here back to the lower court. You notice the other court went to the district court, right to the lower court. This one's going to the appellate court. Found that a little bit interesting. Hopefully this will be able to get back to that lower court. And all the parties, they can then, they're allowed to amend their complaints to tidy up these issues now that the court sees from them. And then move forward, given those that they can. The procedural hurdles should have been cleared here, not, they should be cleared here in a couple of days, actually, relative to equity time for an injunction. It should go pretty quick. But it appears that at least one of the parties identified in the dissent of the case should be able to move forward with her case against Facebook and the Biden regime if the others can't, right? So this is very interesting. This could come back pretty quick if there's a wrong decision in the lower court relative to this finding. She may even want here, but if you listen carefully, the courts have questioned the future look for equity. She may want to even add in her amending complaint a damages claim at law, not in equity, but at law for the past harm that they acknowledge at the Supreme Court already, or to protect her in case that she cannot establish an ongoing or future harm for the equity relief that they need now that they're claiming. So at least she adjusts a bit of the claim that keeps it in the court. Justice Barrett's opinion that standing as to her complaint is tenuous nevertheless seems to me to be an admission that Hines has standing and it exists for the purpose of crossing that threshold entry into the court. At this stage, they talk about this stage, at this stage that should be sufficient for further due process considerations, which are rules challenges, essentially. So all that prior said, I'm having a hard time reconciling the internet claims that the Supreme Court is siding with Biden to allow government coercion. That's not what this opinion does. And even if you are riding with Biden, riding, siding, or Biden aside, taken on face value and any sleazy evasion tactic, not evidence that I can see yet, the complainants produced no direct evidence that their government defendant did anything against them. Now, I'm not happy to read that and this procedural fundamental failure on, quote, one of the most important free speech cases to reach the Supreme Court in years, the dissent said. But there it is for all of us to see. Let me ask this in a different way. Would my listener want to have to suffer a lawsuit the accuser of which did not have to evidentiarily directly connect each and every cause to you? Is what the court answered here. I think most people would say no. The accuser needs a tangible, concrete, and particularized evidence of my direct causation of demonstrable harm before having any right to enter the courts. And that's been the law and what this new standing issue is all about. The challenge of the jurisdiction. Have you complied? Did you meet those elements? If the door of the court never opened to the accuser, how can that equate to the court siding with the accused having never decided anything on this case. And that is my problem with the consistent mischaracterization of this case that I've been watching coming through the media and stuff, and others, actually, in the other cases, by those I thought knew better. And I guess it's part of my disappointment. It sounded like I thought they knew better, or they should have known better. But this is clearly explained, these cases. Another thing that's kind of interesting, how clearly they are explained. But in these perilous times, we all need to know better, I think, and more quickly, without distraction. And that's my main course of action here behind Woodshed, trying to get us to get focused in on what really we need to do, because it's easy to be distracted, waste our time. It's one of the things that I think you hear all the time. I'm trying to get people to apprehend these points. To me, again, it's no silver bullet, but it's a lot better to go that way than to make it up and find out eventually that you're wrong. And what I want y'all to know about this problem as we walk through the muck and the mire known as the internet, while you are searching for a solid material to be better informed and aware, learn to discern more quickly. Take your own course. Though this is more strenuous, you take the road less traveled. Right, Gary O? Protect yourself from any killer hive mind making a lemming's leap. You got to get you behind a woodshed now. No better time than now to do better. That's what I talk about here. That's what I'm talking. I'm not just reading these things. I don't need to read these things. It just seems that so many people are getting it wrong. And that leads other people to get it wrong. It's just like this domino effect of wrongness. You know what I mean? We're not effectual is the point. That's the wrongness. So this is a reminder. Let's not do what experts do or wrongly respond, as in the misery case, the legal professionals, to what they didn't do, but were supposed to. I hope I've said something today that rights the ship of state for you a little bit, gets us oriented a little bit better, so that we can protect ourselves better, so we don't lose sight of what really is supposed to go on, so we read more closely what didn't go on that we are supposed to avoid. And, this has been episode BTWRLM 584, and I'll be with you next week, Tech Diffs, or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near, behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three, Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn, dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned, Hal's words ignite. Next.
next week, heed the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.